Chapter 7. Into the company's employ, he was stationed on Savo. When a consumptive colonial was sent to take his place, he beat him up with his fists, and sent him off a wreck in the schooner that brought him. Mr. Avaby next selected a young Yorkshire giant to relieve Munster. The Yorkshire man had a reputation as a bruiser and preferred fighting to eating. But Munster wouldn't fight. He was a regular little lamb for 10 days, at the end of which time the Yorkshire man was prostrated by a combined attack of dysentery and fever. Then Munster went for him, among other things getting him down, and jumping on him a score or so of times, afraid of what would happen when his victim recovered. Munster fled away in a cutter to Guvudu, where he signalized himself by beating up a young Englishman already crippled by a Boer bullet through both hips. Then it was that Mr. Avaby sent Munster to Lord Howe, the falling-off place. He celebrated his landing by mopping up half a case of gin, and by thrashing the elderly and wheezy mate of the schooner which had brought him. When the schooner departed, he called the Kanakas down to the beach, and challenged them to throw him in a wrestling bout, promising a case of tobacco to the one who succeeded. 3 Kanakas he threw, but was promptly thrown by a 4th, who, instead of receiving the tobacco, got a bullet through his lungs. And so began Munster's reign on Lord Howe. 3,000 people lived in the principal village, but it was deserted, even in broad day, when he passed through. Men, women, and children fled before him. Even the dogs and pigs got out of the way, while the king was not above hiding under a mat. The 2 prime ministers lived in terror of Munster, who never discussed any moot subject, but struck out with his fists instead. And to Lord Howe came Mackay, to toil for Munster for 8 long years and a half. There was no escaping from Lord Howe. For better or worse, Munster and he were tied together. Munster weighed 200 pounds. Mackay weighed 110. Munster was a degenerate brute, but Mackay was a primitive savage. While both had wills and ways of their own, Mackay had no idea of the sort of master he was to work for. He had had no warnings, and he had concluded as a matter of course that Munster would be like other white men, a drinker of much whiskey, a ruler and a lawgiver who always kept his word, and who never struck a boy undeserved. Munster had the advantage. He knew all about Mackay, and gloated over the coming into possession of him. The last cook was suffering from a broken arm and a dislocated shoulder, so Munster made Mackay cook and general houseboy. And Mackay soon learned that there were white men and white men. On the very day the schooner departed, he was ordered to buy a chicken from Samazee, the native Tongan missionary. But Samazee had sailed across the lagoon, and would not be back for 3 days. Mackay returned with the information. He climbed the steep stairway the house stood on piles 12 feet above the sand, and entered the living room to report. The trader demanded the chicken. Mackay opened his mouth to explain the missionary's absence. But Munster did not care for explanations. He struck out with his fist. The blow caught Mackay on the mouth, and lifted him into the air. Clear through the doorway he flew, across the narrow veranda, breaking the top railing, and down to the ground. His lips were a conscious, shapeless mass, and his mouth was full of blood and broken teeth. "That'll teach you that back talk, don't go with me," the traitor shouted, purple with rage, peering down at him over the broken railing. Mackay had never met a white man like this, and he resolved to walk small and never offend. He saw the boat boys knocked about, and one of them put in irons for 3 days with nothing to eat for the crime of breaking a rowlock while pulling. Then too, he heard the gossip of the village and learned why Munster had taken a 3rd wife by force, as was well known. The 1st and 2nd wives lay in the graveyard, under the white coral sand, with slabs of coral rock at head and feet. They had died, it was said, from beatings he had given them. The 3rd wife was certainly ill-used, as Mackay could see for himself. But there was no way by which to avoid offending the white man who seemed offended with life. When Mogai kept silent, he was struck and called a sullen brute. When he spoke, he was struck for giving back talk. When he was grave, Bunster accused him of plotting and gave him a thrashing in advance. And when he strove to be cheerful and to smile, he was charged with sneering at his lord and master and given a taste of stick. Bunster was a devil. The village would have done for him had it not remembered the lesson of the three schooners. It might have done for him anyway if there had been a bush to which to flee. As it was, the murder of the white men, of any white man, would bring a man of war that would kill the offenders and chop down the precious coconut trees. Then there were the boat boys, with minds fully made up to drown him by accident at the first opportunity to capsize the cutter. Only Bunster saw to it that the boat did not capsize. Mogai was of a different breed, and escape being impossible while Bunster lived, he was resolved to get the white man. The trouble was that he could never find a chance. Bunster was always on guard. Day and night his revolvers were ready to hand. He permitted nobody to pass behind his back, as Maki learned after having been knocked down several times. Bunster knew that he had more to fear from the good-natured, even sweet-faced, Malaita boy than from the entire population of Lord Howe, and it gave added zest to the program of torment he was carrying out. And Mogai walked small, accepted his punishments, and waited. All other white men had respected his tambos, but not so Bunster. Maki's weekly allowance of tobacco was 2 sticks. Bunster passed them to his woman, and ordered Mogai to receive them from her hand. But this could not be, and Mogai went without his tobacco. In the same way he was made to miss many a meal, and to go hungry many a day. He was ordered to make chowder out of the big clams that grew in the lagoon. This he could not do, for clams were tambo. 6 times in succession he refused to touch the clams, and 6 times he was knocked senseless. Bunster knew that the boy would die first, but called his refusal mutiny, and would have killed him had there been another cook to take his place. One of the traitor's favorite tricks was to catch Maki's kinky locks and bat his head against the wall. Another trick was to catch Mogai unawares, and thrust the live end of a cigar against his flesh. This Bunster called vaccination, and Mogai was vaccinated a number of times a week. Once, in a rage, Bunster ripped the cup handle from Maki's nose, tearing the hole clear out of the cartilage. "Oh, what a mug," was his comment when he surveyed the damage he had wrought. "The skin of a shark is like sandpaper, but the skin of a ray fish is like a rasp. In the South Seas the natives use it as a wood file in smoothing down canoes and paddles." Bunster had a mitten made of ray fish skin. The first time he tried it on Maki, with one sweep of the hand it fetched the skin off his back from neck to armpit. Bunster was delighted. He gave his wife a taste of the mitten, and tried it out thoroughly on the boat boys. The prime ministers came in for a stroke each, and they had to grin and take it for a joke. "Laugh, damn you, laugh," was the cue he gave. Mogai came in for the largest share of the mitten. Never a day passed without a caress from it. There were times when the loss of so much cuticle kept him awake at night, and often the half-healed surface was raked raw fresh by the facetious Mr. Bunster. Mogai continued his patient wait, secure in the knowledge that sooner or later his time would come. And he knew just what he was going to do, down to the smallest detail, when the time did come. One morning Bunster got up in a mood for knocking 7 bells out of the universe. He began on Maki, and wound up on Maki, in the interval knocking down his wife and hammering all the boat boys. At breakfast he called the coffee slops, and threw the scalding contents of the cup into Maki's face. By 10 o'clock Bunster was shivering with ague, and half an hour later he was burning with fever. It was no ordinary attack. It quickly became pernicious, and developed into black water fever. The days passed, and he grew weaker and weaker, never leaving his bed. Mogai waited and watched, the while his skin grew intact once more. He ordered the boys to beach the cutter, scrub her bottom, and give her a general overhauling. They thought the order emanated from Munster, and they obeyed. But Munster at the time was lying unconscious and giving no orders. This was Mackey's chance, but still he waited. When the worst was past, and Munster lay convalescent and conscious, but weak as a baby, Mackey packed his few trinkets, including the china cup handle, into his trade box. Then he went over to the village and interviewed the king and his two prime ministers. "This fella Munster, him good fella you like too much?" he asked. They explained in one voice that they liked the traitor not at all. The ministers poured forth a recital of all the indignities and wrongs that had been heaped upon them. The king broke down and wept. Mackay interrupted rudely. "You save me big fella Marster my country. You know like em this fella white Marster. Me know like em plenty good you put 100 coconut, 200 coconut, 300 coconut along cutter. Him finish, you go sleep em good fella. Altogether Kanaka sleep em good fella. Bime by big fella noise along house, you know save hear em that fella noise. You altogether sleep strong fella too much." In like manner Mackay interviewed the boat boys. Then he ordered Bunster's wife to return to her family house. Had she refused, he would have been in a quandary, for his tambo would not have permitted him to lay hands on her. The house deserted, he entered the sleeping room, where the traitor lay in a doze. Mackay first removed the revolvers, then placed the ray fish mitten on his hand. Bunster's first warning was a stroke of the mitten that removed the skin the full length of his nose. "Good fella, eh?" Mackay grinned, between two strokes, one of which swept the forehead bare, and the other of which cleaned off one side of his face. "El laugh, damn you, laugh." Mackay did his work thoroughly, and the Kanakas, hiding in their houses, heard the ick fella noise that Bunster made and continued to make for an hour or more. When Mackay was done, he carried the boat compass and all the rifles and ammunition down to the cutter, which he proceeded to ballast with cases of tobacco. It was while engaged in this that a hideous, skinless thing came out of the house, and ran screaming down the beach till it fell in the sand, and mowed and gibbered under the scorching sun. Mackay looked toward it and hesitated. Then he went over and removed the head, which he wrapped in a mat, and stowed in the stern locker of the cutter. So soundly did the Kanaka sleep through that long hot day, that they did not see the cutter run out through the passage and head south, close hauled on the southeast trade. Nor was the cutter ever sighted on that long tack to the shores of Isabel, and during the tedious head beat from there to Malaita. He landed at Port Adams with a wealth of rifles and tobacco such as no one man had ever possessed before. But he did not stop there. He had taken a white man's head, and only the bush could shelter him. So back he went to the bush villages, where he shot old Fanfoa and half a dozen of the chief men, and made himself the chief over all the villages. When his father died, Mackey's brother ruled in Port Adams, and joined together, saltwater men and bushmen. The resulting combination was the strongest of the 10 fighting tribes of Malaita. More than his fear of the British government was Mackey's fear of the all-powerful Moongliam Soap Company, and one day a message came up to him in the bush, reminding him that he owed the company 8.5 years of labor. He sent back a favorable answer, and then appeared the inevitable white man, the captain of the schooner, the only white man during Mackey's reign, who ventured the bush, and came out alive. This man not only came out, but he brought with him $750 in gold sovereigns, the money price of 8 years, and a half of labor plus the cost price of certain rifles and cases of tobacco. Mackay no longer weighs 110 pounds. His stomach is 3 times its former girth, and he has 4 wives. He has many other things, rifles and revolvers, the handle of a china cup, and an excellent collection of bushmen's heads. But more precious than the entire collection is another head, perfectly dried and cured, with sandy hair and a yellowish beard, which is kept wrapped in the finest of fiber lava lavas. When Mogai goes to war with villages beyond his realm, he invariably gets out this head, and alone in his grass palace, contemplates it long and solemnly. At such times the hush of death falls on the village, and not even a Pekanani dares make a noise. The head is esteemed the most powerful devil on Malaita, and to the possession of it is ascribed all of Maki's greatness. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.